Pigment and lesions can pose a diagnostic conundrum for even the most experienced dermatologists. Despite the innovation of imaging tools such as dermoscopy and confocal microscopy, dermatologists rely heavily on the help of dermatopathologists for proper diagnosis. Similarly, dermatopathologists also struggle with pigmented lesions that are not clearly benign or malignant. The emergence of new laboratory technologies based on genetic and molecular profiles are improving the classification of these challenging lesions. In this dialogue, Dr. Martin Mim and Dr. Gary Bronner help us understand these new melanoma markers.
Today I have a real pleasure because I'm interviewing Dr. Martin Mim, who 50 years ago first became my friend and associate at the Mass General Hospital. We were not exactly co-residents together, but we were pretty close. And I've known him all these years and respected him all these years as he's developed as one of the world's foremost dermatopathologists. And we're going to be talking today about newer developments in dermatopathologic interpretation of possible melanomas to help us differentiate those lesions that are dangerous and those lesions that really probably are not melanoma. Marty, you've been in the history of differentiation, if you want to call it that, or distinction of melanoma since day zero. I remember when I was first starting my residency that you and people like Wallace Clark and the Mass General were for the first time really taking melanosarcoma and differentiating it and its clinical aspects to help dermatologists to be able to differentiate a funny-looking nevus, a so-called active junctional, from a true melanoma, and first developing the hallmarks of the irregularity of the contours and irregularity of colors as the primary clinical features that we were supposed to utilize in differentiating nevi from melanoma. So there, in terms of dividing lines, because it's a spectrum of regular-looking nevus, funny-looking nevus, and then melanoma, there you were helping to make a defining line for dermatologists to say, one second, this is a lesion that's got to be biopsied because it really is suspicious, and then we can go to the dividing line that the pathologists use to differentiate a funny nevus from a melanoma. From that point on, at least in the past two decades, we've gone to dermoscopy, those who do a dermoscopy, where, again, using clinical features and, again, trying to refine that line of where is it that we are going to draw the line in our spectrum of funny-looking lesion, a dangerous-looking lesion, and melanoma. So, again, the definition is becoming a little bit more sophisticated. But why is it that we need to do that in dermatopathology? I thought the line was a secure line. We know what a nevus looks like. We know what an atypical or so-called dysplastic nevus looks like, supposedly. We know what a Spitz nevus looks like, supposedly. We know what recurrent melanocytic proliferation looks like after a nevus has been removed, presumably. Why do we have to get more sophisticated about making a dividing line and using more specialized tests?
Well, Gary, first of all, thank you for giving me this opportunity to be with you as an old friend, and I appreciate it very much. Gary, what is really fascinating is that pathology is much less of a strictly defined discipline than many people think. The point is that in all aspects of pathology, there are lesions that are clearly benign and clearly malignant, and then there are what we call borderline lesions. The greatest example of that is the borderline lesion of the ovary, which is an example of a tumor that sometimes metastasizes, usually does not. Well, it turns out that in melanocytic lesions, especially, there's quite variation in especially the severely atypical dysplastic nevi from melanoma in situ or early invasive melanoma, and the proliferative lesions that are the Spitz-like tumors that have the potential for metastasis. The dividing line comes when we deal with something other than the classical picture. Now, the classical picture, it is interesting, Gary, just that you went back to how we define the different clinical aspects of this. And this really was a labor of love where we took lesions and divided them. We sectioned them multiply into 90 sections and we correlate 90 sections with all aspects of the clinical appearance, and we learned what melanomas look like. Now we have dermoscopy, which we also can do exactly the same with. In many studies, there are studies from the United States, there are studies especially from Germany, where they have correlated histological features with the dermoscopic features. Now, taking first the question of dermoscopy, dermoscopy to me is an extremely great advance in dermatology. And it really does allow people to have much more certainty, I think, in taking off lesions and also more certainty in leaving lesions behind. I use dermoscopy in my own practice, and because I practice dermatology as well, and I would say that I probably take off about a third less lesions using dermoscopy than I do with the naked eye, because there are well-defined lesions for example, for pigmented actinic keratoses, often for seborrheic keratoses and so on, that help you to differentiate those lesions that can be clinically black and brown and so on, to differentiate them from malignant lesions. As far as microscopy is concerned, the issue is that we have a spectrum of lesions that occur. We'll start from the point of view of lesions that are Spitz tumors or Spitz-like lesions that kill. In order to find out more about these lesions, I had an opportunity to collect from my friends around the country and around the world. Richard Scolier helped me in Australia as well, as did Klaus Busom and several other people, to get together lesions in children that died from melanoma. And these were children who were less than 13 years of age. And in all the instances of those 18 lesions that we had, those cases you would have diagnosed as melanoma, period. If it was in a child or an adult, it was clearly a malignant lesion. There was one lesion that had Spitz-like features and would have been a problem, but the others were clearly melanoma. So we do have, actually, lesions in children that can kill children, and you can really apply to those lesions the same criteria that we use for prognostication in adults. Then in children, we also have the Spitz nevus. Now, why is the Spitz nevus a problem in children? For several reasons. In the first 2 years of life, there's a pagetoid lesion that occurs in children on the head and neck especially, that is often called melanoma in situ because it has such extensive pagetoid spread. But it is one that is associated with always very discrete nests of benign cells at the periphery of the areas of pagetoid spread, or has some pagetoids, some benign nests admixed with the pagetoid cells. And the cells do not have malignant morphology. They are Spitz nevus-like cells with a very characteristic cytoplasm and so on. That's one lesion that causes a problem in children. The other lesions that cause problem in children are the nodular Spitz nevi that proliferate rapidly. And these lesions will present as a nodule. They usually are not ulcerated, but they will show quite significant mitotic activity, especially in the superficial part of the lesion. I see these in consultation quite frequently. The issue is that the mitoses are most commonly in the superficial part of the lesion, and the lesion will show maturation of the cells. The cells break up into single cells or in small nests as they descend in the dermis, or they will infiltrate in a very diffuse single cell pattern. That is the type of maturation we see that allows one to understand that it is a Spitz nevus rather than a melanoma that doesn't mature but continues as a proliferative nodule that usually shows a more malignant histology deeper than superficially. However, because these lesions have a lot of mitotic activity in them, they are often called malignant. And one has to be very careful with that. I myself will describe them as lesions with mitotic activity, but I will, in a note, say that this I consider to be a variant of the Spitz nevus with mitoses and would simply conservatively excise the lesion. So then you get to the malignant lesions in children, and as I said before, they have a malignant morphology in the cases where the children really go on to die. Then we go from children to adolescents and adults. Now, it is very unusual to have a Spitz nevus in very late life, but I can tell you that I have seen classic Spitz nevi in people in their 60s. They have a typical history of rapid onset, and they have the clear-cut morphology. So you can see Spitz nevi even in advanced adult, but they're very rare. So most of the lesions in adulthood, one is a bit circumspect if they look like a Spitz nevus and make sure that they have the criteria of the Spitz nevus. Where the difficulty comes in is where the lesions form expansile nodules, rather than being lesions that have superficial nests that break up into smaller nests and single cells and mature. Rather than maturing, they form large expansile nodules. These lesions can be 6 to 7 millimeters in size. These are the lesions that have a potential for metastasis in some persons. And the issue is, though, do these lesions go on to kill? And I'm talking now about what we call the atypical Spitz nevus or atypical Spitz tumor.
So metastasis is not a criterion enough to call something a cancer.
I believe that we have to be very circumspect. The fact that a lesion goes to a regional node only is something that we have to be circumspect about. Because, you know, blue nevi also have been known to metastasize to the regional node and go no further. Bronchial adenomas have been known to metastasize and go no further to nodes in the hilum. So there are some biological lesions that have the potential to extend to a node but don't necessarily go on to kill. Now, what is important about that is a series that Ludgate put out in Cancer in late 2010 or 2011, but Ludgate from Michigan. They had approximately 69 patients, as I recall, and of those 69 patients, they were all lesions with atypical Spitz tumors, so expansile nodules in adults mainly. Of those lesions, the follow-up was approximately 6 years, I believe, the overall follow-up, but they had follow-up from a few months to years. None of those patients died but one. All those patients had sentinel lymph node biopsies. All those patients had positive sentinel lymph nodes. The one patient who died in that series, curiously, was a person who refused to have a sentinel lymph node. Now, there must be a message maybe in that, or maybe it's simply that's an isolated case, but I find that very interesting. But my message is the fact that even a Spitz tumor metastasized to a lymph node doesn't necessarily mean the patient will go on to die. Now remember in 1989, Kathleen Smith published for the first time what she called metastasizing Spitz tumors. And this was a group of tumors that metastasized to regional lymph nodes and did not go on. And I saw Dr. Smith approximately 6 years ago at a meeting, and I asked her, to her knowledge, had any of those patients died? And she said, to her knowledge, as of that time, none of those patients had died. This was 1989. Now, that was her, to her knowledge, she said. But it's very interesting, and I think that this allows us to know that there are going to be tumors that can go to regional nodes, and those are the ones that we want to try and identify better. I myself use the term atypical Spitz nevus or atypical Spitz tumor. What do I differentiate? The atypical Spitz tumor will be one with a lot of mitotic activity. The atypical Spitz nevus will have limited mitotic activity. But I'll say to them that because they are associated with mitotic activity, they have a risk of metastasis. And I'll put that in a note and say, but I'll leave the decision for a lymph node, sentinel lymph node dissection to the patient and the surgeon to decide. So then, how can we better understand these lesions? Now, that's where some of these new molecular techniques come in, which are very, very helpful in the sense that they're leading us in a direction. They are very early on, and the technique that I have the most faith in is the CGH, the comparative genomic hybridization technique, because this allows one to view the entire genome and see abnormalities in the genome. Now, Boris Bastian and Philip Lavoie have championed this technique at UCSF, and they've written some excellent articles on them. And Boris is working just now with several places, including Federation Medicine in Cambridge, and studying the genomics of Spitz nevi, atypical Spitz tumors, and Spitzoid melanomas. The results of those are partly published, and some of the results are still unpublished. But the point is that, for one thing, an increased copy of 11P is associated with a Spitz nevus, and that is a benign lesion. There are a few other abnormalities with Spitz nevi, but they are minimal. Whereas in melanoma, in the comparative genomic hybridization, you have multiple hits. You have increases in some chromosomes, decreases in other chromosomes, but multiple hits are involved. The gray area, the atypical Spitz tumors, is currently under study. I recently have collected a group of 28 Spitz tumors that metastasize to regional nodes with survival that are being studied at Federation Medicine using next generation techniques of a genetic analysis, of molecular analysis, to determine if we can identify them in a special way compared to Spitz nevi and melanoma.
So classic non-Spitz looking melanoma have the multiple hits, is that
right.
What you're saying?
That's right.
And Spitz nevi have just that one hit
or
that
two
tells you it's
at the
benign.
Most, right.
And it's the question mark Spitzian melanomas versus just really atypical Spitz tumor that is being defined better with these stains now.
Exactly.
But the classic non-Spitzian melanoma does have these hits.
They have certain other abnormalities, but they're distinct and different from Spitz nevus.
Now, do you use or recommend these new genomic tests often for questionable non-Spitzian melanomas?
When I have a tumor that I'm very concerned of, and I'm not sure if it's really a Spitz nevus or a Spitzoid melanoma, I will send for comparative genomic hybridization.
What about ones that are not Spitzian, that don't look like Spitz tumors?
I don't send them.
I make those diagnoses. Because you make the diagnosis
by light microscopy. That's
light
right.
Microscopy.
That's right, exactly. I use them for problem lesions. Now, we also have the FISH technique. And the FISH technique has been helpful because they mainly are dealing with abnormalities in chromosome 6. And Pedro Jerome has done the leading work with this with Joao Guittard and also with Boris Bastian and Philip Lebois. Now, FISH is very sensitive in melanoma and very sensitive in benign lesions, but again, it is much less sensitive, only about 60% sensitivity in the borderline lesions. So again, we're looking for further definition from the FISH techniques to help us to understand these lesions better as well.
Because it's the borderline lesions that are the ones with the question mark.
Right,
exactly. Not the classical ones that are easy to do without having to go to specialized testing.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Marty, when you're doing special immunotesting on the melanomas, are you doing it for other than diagnostic reasons now? Are there reasons that the oncologists want to do special biomarker type testing so they
absolutely.
Can target the tumors?
Great question, Gary. This is the new world for pathologists, and that is doing the marker studies that allow us to identify targets. People who respond to vemurafenib, the new agent, that is the agent that inhibits a BRAF pathway when a BRAF is mutated. It is interesting that they found, and this is work of Jan Wargo and Keith Flaherty and Adriano Puris at the Mass General. Also, Scholier and his group, Georgina Long in Australia, found this as well. When the BRAF inhibitor is used and successful, the tumors become infiltrated by lymphocytes, and they are CD8 positive granzyme B positive killer cells. So they are actually the way in which the inhibition of the BRAF allows for these tumor cells to be infiltrated by killer cells, and they're killed. Now, what's fascinating about it is that the tumor cells have also been shown to express MART1. And MART1 is an antigen for which there are antibodies directed in therapy. The point is that in melanoma today, the role of the pathologist has become very, very important in, for example, the new program death ligand studies with PD-L and PD-L1 and 2. The pathologist now screens the melanoma for the presence of either PD-1 or the presence of the ligands PD-L1 or PD-L2. PD-L1 is the most common, I think, that is the patients are screened for to see if they possess that, because if they have that, they're then sensitive to the antibodies against that block the PD-L interaction. This was one of the checkpoints that nature has, that we normally all have, and these are checkpoints that impede our immune response. The tumors use them to avoid the immune response. So, for example, a tumor that has a PD-L on it, a receptor for the ligand, if the ligand interacts with that receptor, the tumor cell undergoes apoptosis or becomes exhausted, as it said. So we now check patients for the presence of PD-L1 by immunohistochemistry, and if the patients have that, then we know that we can treat them. They may respond to this new therapy, which is an antibody directed against the PD-L antigen.
All these episodes are discrete episodes. You're saying that if you see what looks like a classic melanoma to you clinically, that's it. You make your diagnosis pathologically, and that's the end.
Right.
If you have a Spitzian-looking thing, and you're not sure whether it's Spitzian melanoma or a Spitz tumor, and you're not sure, you scratch your head, and you may do one of these immunoassays to try to figure out whether that will help you more.
Right.
And once the diagnosis is made, it's only then that you use the biomarker tests. You don't use the biomarker tests as a diagnostic feature?
The biomarker comes to the patients who have the metastasis, and you're looking now for treating metastases. That's where that comes in. But certainly some of the point is that some of the trials that use the MART1 as the antigen that they're directing therapy against, the oncologist will directly ask you to perform MART1. And so on all their melanomas, and then they know if they can use an agent that will block MART1.
And so on your primary diagnosis, you've made a diagnosis of melanoma, and so there it is in the record, and then they will ask, even if it's not metastasized, do this assay in the beginning on the primary tumor.
Right. That's right.
You know, that's,
so they have that information for
which is something new, and they know that for the future.
Right.
Because if the patient gets a metastasis, then I presume, then they might try one of these
agents.
That's
exactly right. Yep.
Okay, so this is now part of the armamentarium.
It is.
And the differentiation further.
And it will become wider in wider usage because they're getting more specific agents against specific antigens.
Now, those specific antigens that are used as biomarkers, are they specific only for melanoma, or are these just are these markers that indicate whether a particular gene has been turned off that doesn't make something necessarily malignant?
Well, no. The MAP kinase pathway is the principal pathway that is activated by RAS, and it's common in other tumors. So actually, the therapy that has now been shown to be so successful in melanoma, even though the patients do recur, but can really have tremendous response, occurs in other tumors as well. And
in the dysplastic nevus?
I'm talking about non-melanoma tumors. It's in other tumors in the body. So it's a very common pathway, and so this information that we're gaining with melanoma will help oncologists to treat other tumors as well.
Well, Marty, I want to thank you for this wonderful view of the new way of looking at pathology slides that are questionable for melanoma, and hope the listeners have an understanding of what the fine-tuning that's occurring in the laboratory is for defining their atypical melanocytic lesions. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Certainly, the diagnosis of pigmented lesions can be difficult. One lesion that can be particularly challenging in children is the Spitz nevus. These lesions encompass a spectrum of disease from benign to deadly. Early in life, melanocytic lesions in children may show pagetoid spread, and therefore be incorrectly classified as melanoma in situ. However, the dermatopathologist can use the identification of benign cells at the periphery of pagetoid regions to help characterize these entities as benign. Nodular Spitz lesions with significant mitotic activity can also be problematic. With careful examination, these also can be differentiated from melanoma based on the fact that the melanocyte nests break up and maturation is present as the lesion descends in the dermis. More difficulty occurs when Spitzoid lesions form expansive nodules that do not mature as the lesion descends into the dermis. These atypical Spitz tumors have been shown to metastasize. The clinical significance of these metastases is a matter of debate, as some lesions, such as blue nevi, have been shown to metastasize but do not increase mortality. In 2009, Ludgate reported a series of 69 cases of atypical Spitz nevi, some of which had positive sentinel node biopsies, in which only one patient died within a 6-year follow-up period. This study supports that some metastases are not associated with increased mortality. Differentiating lesions such as atypical Spitz tumors from Spitzoid melanoma poses the greatest challenge. It is in these areas of uncertainty that comparative genomic hybridization can be helpful. Studies are currently underway to evaluate the significance of gene profiles in Spitz nevi, atypical Spitz tumor, and Spitzoid melanomas. One recent discovery is that increased copies of 11p are associated with a benign Spitz nevus. Spitzoid melanomas appear to have more chromosome alterations than their benign counterparts. Furthermore, special stains are helping to differentiate Spitzoid melanomas from atypical Spitz tumors. An additional genetic technique, fluorescence in situ hybridization, or FISH, can also be helpful in differentiating benign lesions from melanomas. With the discovery of new tumor markers, the dermatopathologist plays an important role on the melanoma treatment team. By determining a tumor's molecular profile, dermatopathologists are able to aid the oncologist in selecting appropriate therapeutics. For example, melanomas can be screened for BRAF, MART1, and PD-L. Oncologists can then use this information to choose the most appropriate treatment option. Ideally, research will help to further elucidate tumor profiles, thereby allowing even more specific treatments. I hope you enjoyed this edition of Dialogues in Dermatology. Next month, we'll have dialogues on a surgical theme, which will feature innovative suture techniques, advances in aesthetic dermatology, and botulinum toxins. Remember to download the Dialogues in Dermatology app for your convenience. Also, we now have a presence on Facebook, and we would like you to join the community online for previews and education made fun. This has been Terry Cronin with Dialogues in Dermatology. Stay passionate about dermatology. Your expertise and continued hard work on behalf of your patients is appreciated and makes your colleagues and your community proud. Have another great month.